Hi, everyone. This is Jaime Alejandro with the Arts Calling Podcast, the place where I interview hardworking independent creatives in the literary, visual, and performing arts. Today, I'm excited to be Arts Calling C.M. Crockford. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest. C.M. Crockford is the author of the full-length collection Bird Songs from Alien Buddha Press, just came out recently, as well as two chapbooks, Mark the Place from 30 West Publishing and A Door from Iron Lung Press. His essays, poetry, and fiction have been featured in the Cleveland Review of Books, Abducted Cow Magazine, Cinespeak Journal, Vestarian, Serotonin Poetry, and Vast Chasm Magazine, among many others. He also co-hosted The Barn, a podcast about The Shield alongside Mason McGuire. Otherwise, Crockford reads crime fiction, collects punk badges and stim toys, and lives in Philadelphia with his cat, Wally. I love that CM and I were able to talk about not only poetry, but movies, music, and all kinds of wonderful things in between. Of course, we primarily talk about his full-length collection, Bird Songs, which is now available from Alien Buddha Press. I hope that you folks go check that out. And without further delay, let's give CM a call. Hello, anybody there?
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, good morning. Hey, Connor, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I'm really excited to get to chat and learn a little bit more about you. Where are you at these days?
So I actually live in West Philadelphia, a little farther from UPenn, but, you know, close enough that I can get there pretty easily, but I'm not too near the students.
Nice, nice. So has that been home for most of your life, or have you moved around a bit?
I've actually moved around a lot. I'm originally from a small town in New Hampshire called Sandwich. Yes, that's the name. And then when I was 18, I went to San Francisco for college. So I went to USF, close to Haight-Ashbury, and stayed there for 4 years, and then moved to Boston for a few years. And then in 2017, late 2017, after some travel, I ended up in Philadelphia and I've been here ever since.
So it feels like home by now. It's definitely a place that you call your go-to home base then.
Yeah, you know, I really like it here. I don't think I'd actually visited before I moved or like started looking around at jobs and stuff. And it's kind of great here because people are very blunt. And they don't care about the rules. Like if the rules are inconvenient or they seem stupid, they're probably not going to follow them.
So pretty common sense people, just a little bit louder about it, right?
Yeah. And I'm autistic and it's actually refreshing because people here generally say what they mean. I don't have a lot of problems with that.
Oh, that's good. That's good to hear. So, yeah. As we start up this conversation about writing, I'd like to go back just a little bit in your earlier years. If we could talk a bit about how you get into writing in particular, how do you find poetry? Because that seems to be the focal point of your creative work. Is that right?
I would say that, yeah. As well as essays, it's funny. I feel like I am not great yet at writing fiction. It's something I have done on an amateur level. But I don't think I have the craft or practice of a lot of like my friends who I think are superior fiction writers. Mm. But yeah, I would say poetry is the focal point. I started writing real poetry, God, when I was probably 13, 14, I wrote a few poems for one of those like youth magazines that they put out for like eighth graders and teenagers to write poetry. And I remember writing one about not wanting to get up like for work, for school. But then the other one was actually about movies and like the movie theater and going to a movie. So, and I was trying to write screenplays at that point, like short screenplays and stuff. So that was an interest of mine. And then I just started getting into poetry. I think the movie poem, oddly, I don't even think that's probably a great poem if I could find it. But it was something where it unlocked a part of my brain I don't think I knew was there.
What was that poem about? Do you remember specifically more than just the movie situation?
It was just an impression of people going into a movie theater, like the sort of transcendent experience you can get from being in a movie theater and being in the dark of all these people. So, you know, probably a little inspired by like Sunset Boulevard, like the monologue at the end, all those cameras, all those people in the dark.
So when you actually start going back to poetry, did you feel like you had a break, or did you kind of move away from it as you started getting older, or what happened there for you? Has it always been a constant in your life, or did you kind of step away from it to pursue something that you thought would be more appropriate?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's been a constant. I've definitely stepped back and forth. Like when I was in Boston, I was actually writing more short fiction at the time, but I was writing a lot of poetry, doing open mics. I did that in college as well, although not as much, obviously. I was so busy with school and writing and actually just learning how to be a writer. My BA's in creative writing and nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And so I really started taking my writing career a little more seriously, probably when I was 24, 25, just having this reaction of, I need something to do. And this is what I need, can focus on. This can be my career. There was also this weird effect of watching The Shield, watching Spartacus, and reading a bunch of James Ellroy all at the same time. So I ended up writing a crime novelette in about like a month.
Oh, wow.
Which never got published, but it's out. It's, you know, it's in my dossier somewhere, my files.
Yeah, but those are usually the ones that teach you something, right? You go back to those and you realize, oh, this is a crossroads moment or something that gave me a bit of inspiration for the next thing. Can you recall, like, even if you're looking back on this work, like, what do you think you learned from that specific crime novella, novelette that you were working on?
I think I learned a little more about how to plot. I think what I really learned was that you can get lost in writing in the best way, that when you are really in that moment, it does feel transcendent. There's this scene, I'm sure you've probably seen Oppenheimer by now, or you know of it.
So this is my biggest like movie sin. I have not seen Oppenheimer yet. So I'm very, very heartbroken that I haven't, but please tell me. Yeah. Yeah.
this is not really a spoiler for the movie. So you're fine. Early on in the movie, one of Oppenheimer's mentors is talking to him about physics, and he asks him, can you hear the music? Like, do you sense something transcendent in this? And that's when you know you're set. And, I feel like I've heard the music in a lot of the things I've written, or the process of writing, I think, is what I've gotten out of it. The transcendence of the process.
I love this word, transcendence. I love that, you know, we're trying to articulate something that feels like it could be another worldly sort of connection, but you seem you have a clear understanding of the need for that structure, the need for something to kind of, to create an appropriate package for the delivery, right? For the delivery of the story, which is essential. But I love the tension that creates, because you're addressing this need for something that doesn't really have a structure, or the transcendence moment. But how do you kind of reconcile that, or how do you view this idea that art is transcendent, and yet we have to get down to the craft level of something and really make it a constructed thing. So how does that work for you?
So lately I've been really interested in the idea of the daemon, that you are talking to your daemon. Mm. And when you're writing or creating, you are in correspondence with something else. And I don't think that creature exists on this plane of existence. I think it's somewhere else. I mean, I guess you could call it your subconsciousness, but isn't it kind of tedious to rationalize this? Like, it's so obvious this isn't rational. Sorry for the noise. The collective unconscious is really what we're dealing with here, right? Or something weird. There is a weirdness to this. And but what's funny is, yes, you are being talked to, but you need to transcribe what's being said, I think. And I think that's where craft and process and form come in. I mean, I love form. I'm trying to experiment more of it these days, especially like Gazel, Senryu and Tankas, anything like that. You know, and I think it's important to actually be able to hash out what is being said to you, because otherwise it can come off as like half formed. It's mm-hmm. not the real thing. It's not the truest version of itself.
Right. Right. So what happens when you get into these smaller forms to you? Do you prefer the smaller, more succinct forms of poetry? What are the benefits of playing in that end of the sandbox? Because they're terrifying. That's probably, to me, the most terrifying thing to do is getting to those very, I don't want to say microscopic, but very succinct pieces of writing. I think it's a beautiful challenge.
It is a beautiful challenge. It's a good description of it. It can be hard. I think like the Japanese forms, like the Tankas and Senryu haikus, those are much easier to learn. But what you actually find as you learn more about the forms themselves is there is a specific way that they need to be written. Like haikus mm-hmm. are very descriptive, for example.
Yeah.
You can't really just kind of go off 5-5-7-5, like, oh, that's it, I'm done. No, you need to respect the process and the tradition of the haiku. This is why sonnets and villanelles, you know, I've tried to write them. They drive me crazy because the rules are hard.
Yeah.
And yeah. conforming to the rules while being creative is really difficult, I think.
Right. And for me, I mean, I just love everything that you're saying just now, because I feel that, you know, my background is in playwriting. So that's really a majority of what I know. And so there is sort of an inherent obsession with structure and form. Mm-hmm. And there's also this other end that you're just trying to follow the rules, but at the same time, wedge in a lot of truth in there. And I was going to ask you something in terms of screenwriting and sort of that interest before we get to Bird Songs, which is your latest collection. But I'm curious, how does screenwriting come in and out of your life as it is now, as it stands?
So I've co-written a short horror film that's in post-production. It's kind of a little stuck in post-production. I'm not sure what the deal is there. I think it's just sound stuff. And I've also, you know, been working with the same collaborator on a few other things, but they're kind of up in the air as well. So, you know, those are relatively new for me. I used to write short film scripts when I was a kid, but I really was not great with the process. I read William Goldman books, but I don't think that's going to make you a great storyteller, obviously, mm-hmm. right? He's a very insightful guy, but that's not going to be the be-all, end-all of writing. It's funny, though, because I've actually done a little more play work and theatrical work. I had a monologue staged in New York called I Now Sit Here Bloody. And that was really satisfying because it felt like I was breaking the rules a bit. It wasn't a poem. It wasn't quite, you know, a total narrative. It's something written in a page. And I really enjoyed writing that. So I want to do more things like that. What's exciting about the stage, and I really got this from reading a lot of Harold Pinter a couple years ago, is that it's just two or three people on a blackboard, and then you kind of unleash them. And Pinter especially is so exciting because he's kind of showing you there are no rules. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not punk, but it's transgressive and really creepy, a lot of his stuff. So very exciting in that sense. I think the stage can be very exciting. I sometimes wish more writers saw it as a place where you can experiment. I feel like some of American theater especially can be really toothless.
I couldn't agree more. As a playwright, I could not agree more, especially Pinter and the poetic leanings of that particular playwright, his aggressiveness. I mean, it's just absolutely brutal in the best way, because it's so surprising and you're not expecting that kind of energy, because everything seems very tame, you know, in some respects. But maybe I'm going to the wrong theaters, you know. But
I think it's funny too, because I think Pinter's hilarious and other people have not had that reaction and they're shocked, because I'm like, no, this is really funny. How do you not see this is funny?
Yeah.
Like, this is like a parody of neurotypical people.
So As we start moving here to the collection, and I love that mm-hmm. you're covering a lot of facets of your creative world, because it has to influence, it has to sort of channel into your latest project. And I'd like to know, just to kind of introduce Birdsongs, if you could tell me a bit about what this collection is, but also if you could share some thoughts about what the act of reading these poems does to the development and how that influenced the assortment of Birdsongs coming together.
Yeah, Birdsongs is the result of a lot of different life events. I think, as with a lot of people publishing right now, in my opinion, so is the result of issues with the pandemic. Like, my brain was just kind of crashing. I would have anxiety attacks in grocery stores. Had a breakup in 2022, and then I moved into an apartment alone for the first time. And started really working on myself, because it became really obvious between 2020 and 2022 that I had all these unresolved problems with PTSD and anxiety and depression that I had never really worked on properly, like high-functioning depression, essentially. And I don't want this book to be defined by trauma and grief either, but, you know, those definitely played a role in the book. But so did punk, and so did the writers I'm interested in, historical events, animals. I've a poem in at least two poems, I think, in the book about cats.
Excellent.
And so it's weird, because I am someone who is exhausted by trauma being a buzzword right now in a lot of popular culture, because I don't think a lot of these people know what trauma means, or they're not really. They think it can be conquered easily. Like, a lot of these movies or books kind of depict it as a problem you can just resolve easily.
Well, I think, sorry to interject on this, but this is a brilliant point. Like, we have something that is as intense, as vast as trauma, let's call it. When we put it into a storytelling structure, what does it do to it? It reduces the trauma to something that has to be solved, beginning, middle, and end, right? So how do you go about structurally solving that problem for yourself? Because this is a great statement. I mean, I think it's very true and spot on. So how does that work for you in your
work? It's funny, because Hereditary, I think, inspired a lot of trauma, horror, but the rest of the horror trauma movies are about how, like, you can resolve this, and Hereditary ends with, there is no resolving this.
It is the truest form of that.
No, but I agree with Elroy that closure is bullshit. you can heal, you know, you can get better, but it might pop up every now and again. You know, some bad things happen to you and you just have to live with it. So, I'm sorry, can you repeat the last question about the book?
Well, going along on this tangent, I think it makes sense to me that you would have some kind of structural apparatus, let's call it, to deal with trauma in a way that doesn't turn trauma trite, or you know, in this sort of traditional cliche arc of resolving trauma, you know, by the last line or the last scene of the play.
Yeah, I wonder about that with the last poem in my book, because I did kind of want to end on a more hopeful note, or a note of resilience, I guess, is probably the best word. And I think resilience is actually the best response sometimes to like really awful situations, is just surviving and maybe being able to sing or do something afterward. But sometimes that's also a cold comfort. You know, some people don't want to be resilient either, and I think that's important too. Vulnerability is good.
Yeah, and it's a difficult thing to write about and to process. So I imagine, you know, people are at various stages of this kind of experience. But for you, and I apologize if I'm jumping back and forth here, because you're reminding me of so many things. The act of readings with your work, how impactful is that for you as you develop this work? That was the other part of the question that I wanted to ask you. Developing this work, do you regularly do readings to hear the poems, or do you just rely on what's on the page a majority of the time?
I do. And it's funny because performance has become very important to me. I mean, it's always been important. I sang in two bands. And so obviously, you know, if you take part in performing music in any way, performance becomes important, and learning how to respond to the crowd, right? However, it's interesting because some of my work, very intentionally, I don't think can be read aloud in a way where it's more performative than based in the language. I am increasingly interested in experimenting with language, especially getting into surrealist poetry, talking heads, like how David Byrne goes for non sequiturs all the time, especially in his later albums, like Remain in Light. Remain in Light is just very much collages of words. And that's become more interesting to me lately, like what sounds good but doesn't necessarily make sense. So that's more important to me these days. When I was younger, I think I was more focused on performance. Now I think it's both.
It's a good blend, right? Yeah, because you really need two sides of a creative coin to originate in your own direction. That's actually kind of nice. So Birdsongs, then, since you've been working at it for a little while, when did you figure out that you had something cohesive, and when did you feel like you were heading in the right direction with this collection? Was there a particular poem that did it for you in the work?
Yeah, when I wrote The Swamp and Salad Days, because they felt like a way to bind the collection together. And Salad Days is probably the longest poem in the book. It's near the end, the penultimate poem. And that was me writing a farewell to the punk scene and kind of to rock as a cultural movement. Not that it's dead. It's just, I don't need it as much as I used to. I don't go to concerts. I'm not as angry as when I was 18 or 19. I was just really angry.
Yeah.
Like, you know, one time after an English workshop that I was not enjoying, it was a 4-hour workshop, I just kicked a garbage can and just smashed it, as I remember. You know, I was just really mad.
Yeah.
And some of that is genetics, and some of that is just malformed reacting to stuff that happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of this book is, I think I started centering it a little bit around like farewell to your past or reckoning with the past.
Mm-hmm.
And that was important to me, reconciling the past and the present. Maybe the future. I think a lot of these poems are about the future in a pretty pessimistic way or a kind of horrific way. The coming or 2023. There's one I was cut called Anthropocene that is particularly bleak. It would have been the bleakest book poem in the book for sure.
Yeah. But I love that there's a catharsis behind the scenes when you're writing a lot of this darker work or things that are an act of expelling something that has been haunting you or maybe getting you ready for the next season of your life. And sure, you've completed the collection. So what is on the horizon in terms of what the book has helped you deal with? What do you think specifically has come out of this collection for you in terms of heading in the right direction?
I plan to write less confessional poetry. As much as I do enjoy it, I did just write one called Confession 2, but even then that's a poem actually about, the Palestinian genocide and about complicity. It was, I wrote it in the middle of the night, like 2 AM. It was very much like the first draft was written when I couldn't sleep, and it just poured out of me into my phone, like the notepad.
Yeah.
And, then when I rewrote it, I was influenced by The Zone of Interest, the recent Jonathan Glazer film about the Holocaust. And my interest lately is writing more about people or historical events or like characters. At the Last Party in South Philly has a lot of characters in it that are based on my friends. And some of them I would definitely like to write about again. I think that would be fun to have like recurring characters, a little like Ricky Lee Jones does, or Bruce Springsteen, where like characters pop up again and again, Mary in Springsteen stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So it, as we move through, like beyond this collection, then do you feel like the city itself, the one that you call home, has made itself a part of the work that you're writing, especially now that you're looking out beyond yourself to find subjects and things like that? Like what parts of the city resonate with you?
I think Philadelphia's essential disinterest in following rules that are inconvenient to them, like I said, but also a mixture of things. We have a really vibrant poetry scene. We have a really diverse city. 50% of the city is black, which I don't fit, which I think is unusual for an American city, especially this populous. There are 2 million people here. That's the biggest city I've ever lived in. And I would also say the vibrant poetry scene here has become a crucial part of my work in the sense of like, I can practice my poetry on people and on audiences. And that's become really important to me. And listening to other poems, other poets, and getting influences from that. Sometimes with imposter syndrome, you feel like Salieri in Amadeus, where you're a little jealous. But we have so many great poets here. Alison Lubar, who you interviewed, Peter Webb, Lauren Wattmeyer, tons of great writers, Adam Giancarfaro. And these are just the Philadelphia area. I mean, Pennsylvania actually is a pretty active scene in and of itself.
So have there been any new things that you've learned from the group, say from, you know, from that community? What are some things that are sticking in your mind that you feel like, holy crap, this was a transformative thing. This was a big leap in understanding poetry. Were there little bits of, I guess, insight that you might've picked up from those readings? Because sadly here in Wyoming, we don't have a lot of readings, but you know, I'm curious of what are some things that have stuck with you in recent months?
Yeah. The sense of different perspectives everywhere in the poetry scene here. We have spoken word writers. We have slam writers. We have people who are clearly just experimenting with language, or they're really writing for an audience. They're trying to be very confrontational and upfront, or they're doing autobiographical work. You have writers who are really writing more philosophical or playful, jazzier work. And I just think the blend of influences in Philadelphia is so great. And it has been a crucial influence on me. I'm really restless. I don't like staying in one artistic lane. I think it would be hard for me to write a book in the same voice over and over, or to write a different book again and again, like the same book. I'm not that guy. I am too restless. My influences are way too wide. I like a lot of different things. And I think that actually the same goes for a lot of Philadelphia writers.
Yeah, it seems you can let loose no matter what direction and then pivot as needed, which is great. Yeah. So how do you make your way to your publishing house with Alien Buddha Press for Bird Songs? Was it a difficult process to find a home for it? Or what was that experience like to get this work out into the world?
That humbling experience, because I got rejected a few times from a few publishers and then had to look at the book again and be like, oh shit, there are adverbs and bad syntax all over this. I've got to rewrite the entire thing. And I did in about 5 or 6 hours, or no, it was a couple days. And then I just kept doing it to the point where I was starting to feel a little insane, because I already write a lot of drafts. People have been shocked when I've been like, oh, I wrote this like 9 times. And I still cut, you know, I still will find words to cut. I think I'm also an editor, so I've edited a lot of books, and I think a lot of the process is cutting, as much as people would prefer to not get rid of the excess. You really do have to kill your darlings. You just do.
And you know, this is such a beautiful delight to see a work get more and more concise as you start cutting. I think that's one of the greatest things ever. I think that's probably a playwriting, dramatic writing thing for you. Cause you know, at least with playwrights, you know, there's a lot of rewrites in that stuff.
One of the things I got out of The Shield and Aristotle and a lot of Greek tragedy is the minimalism. Is that the the structures can be boiled down to, you know, mere sentences. I mean, if you outlined Oedipus the King, it's actually a pretty simple plot. You know, he finds out there's something wrong. He investigates. He discovers it's him all along. And then, you know, tragedy unfolds. It's the first detective story. And it's a very simple story if you actually think about it. So, yeah, I think it's crucial. Dramatic writing was definitely a big influence on me then. I actually wish more writers were influenced by drama as a concept. I think that's a problem right now. A lot of people, like everyone should read Poetics. Even if you aren't writing Phaedra, you should read Poetics by Aristotle.
I second that. I echo those sentiments. Mm-hmm. We have to go back mm-hmm. to the greats and worship at the altar of your favorite Greek tragedians. I would say Euripides, but some people like Sophocles a little bit more. They like their structure a little bit harder. But let's go for it. I think before we move on, though, I want to talk to you about your podcasting experience with The Shield. Tell me about this podcasting experience that you did. You co-hosted a podcast about The Shield. And I'd like you to share a bit more about what that means to you to have something that inspires you so much that you create a podcast about it and you want to go in depth about some of the specifics of that show.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not doing that about Succession. That's for fucking sure. I mean, God knows, some of my friends are like mega fans, but they don't know. I'm like, five things happen per season. You're getting cheated. Like, they're ripping you off of your time. Like, 100 things happen in a season of The Shield. Like, I would say like 100 plot beats happen in The Shield. Mm. And I'm like, this is actually engaging me. So I started that with a friend of mine who was also a huge fan of the show. He hadn't watched it in a long time. I just did recently. And so I was like thinking of writing a Shield podcast. And he was like, this is a great idea. We've got to do this. So we co-hosted for about 2 years and brought on a bunch of guests. We brought on Zoe Z, crime writer, Jason Pinter, Grant Niebel. He's a UCLA professor who's written extensively about The Shield. He's an incredibly smart guy. And so we just had a great time just talking about the show. And I think the reason I want to write to talk about it so much is that it's such a perfect tragedy. And also, but also a perfect drama. And of course, those are technically separate. But the show's minimalism and force, like the blunt force of it, like watching the show sometimes feels like you're getting clubbed in the head. It's so powerful. And I just think that a lot of other TV shows could get tips from it in terms of the writing, the sense of dramatic emphasis. And also it's, I would call it a biblical power. I think the show has biblical power.
Yeah.
Like the some of the dialogue is, it's funny because it's pulpy and corny sometimes, but when the writing's good, there's something really didactic about the writing. Like, you're my friend, will you help me? Mm-hmm. Like it's dialogue at its brute essence, and I love it.
Yeah. It's so vital. I think that's one of the great things, or at least the challenge to aspire in dramatic writing, because you've got it spot on. This sort of biblical, larger-than-life sort of humanity coming at you with such an intensity that I think it's such a fine line between, as you say, it's corny, elevated, but also true to its transcendent sort of definition. Yeah. But I'd like to.
I mean, I love B-movies. Go ahead. I love horror. So. No. I was just going to say, I love B-movies. I love horror. So, you know, corny is not a problem for me sometimes. I'm just like, whatever. Yeah. I'll go with it. I am in this zone.
I love that. I think you're speaking my same language here. And I love it because people shy away from the ridiculous. They shy away from something that plays grander, the absurd, you know, especially when we're talking about stage and TV and things, everything's going to be safe. So I'd like you to elaborate a little bit more on the state of entertainment at this time, because I love your perspective on this. I want not to have you go on a rant, but I just feel like you're spot on in the way that you're talking about this. And I really feel like I'm right there with you. So I'd like you to tell me, you know, aesthetically, what do you think doesn't line up right now? Because there does seem to be a disconnect.
You know, a lot of it is material. It's that the tech companies are in entertainment now, and they are run by people who do not like movies or television, and or they don't care about them. I mean, I don't know if you read about David Zaslav trying to watch Fleabag, but like, he covered his eyes during the sex scenes, and I'm like, why are you running a media company? Why? Oh, you don't like television that much. You like reality TV, and I respect that, but go run a reality TV show. I think so. We have that problem. We have the material disconnect. We have this problem of massive wealth inequality where no one wants to write about poor, lower middle class people anymore at all, I think, in mainstream television or film. And especially not well. I mean, what was the last show about poor people we got? Shameless? Like, Shameless is like poor people cosplay, and it basically makes them look disgusting and depraved, which is fine, but it's not true. It's kind of mean, actually. Like Malcolm in the Middle is much nicer about how people struggle to make ends meet, you know? So I think we have this problem of the material. We have this problem where no one knows how to cut the, how to, you know, get rid of the excess. I'm not going to say cut off the fat. I think that sounds weird. Get rid of the excess of everything. Everything is excessive. Like Netflix bloat is this huge problem, right? Mm. Where every movie is too long. They don't know when to end.
Yeah.
So it seems like the principles of basic storytelling are getting diluted and hurt in the process of all this. I mean, you know, we have people like Christopher Nolan. We have people like Jonathan Glazer. We have Greta Gerwig, and these are really promising people, great filmmakers or really promising talents. Although I'm worried about Gerwig doing a Narnia show for Netflix. I don't want her to do that under any capacity. I don't care about Narnia. I have never cared that much about Narnia. So yeah, you have this problem too, where nothing's original, everything's IP. It's a lot of it is material and economic stuff, frankly. It's consolidation of power. It's corporations owning everything. Everything's getting smaller and smaller. Income is getting smaller and smaller. And the people who run the world don't really like art, or they don't like weird art. And that is a serious problem when you have an economy that is meant to be universal at this point. Like capitalism is everywhere, right? It chokes you. It's suffocating. I would call myself an anti-capitalist, I guess. I mean, I sell my own books as well, so I'm a capitalist by default. But if this was gone the next day, I would be like, great, where do I go? Where do I sign up for like an administrative role? I will happily transition us away from this nightmare.
Well, that's the thing, right? Spot on, bravo. I definitely agree on all fronts there. But this is the world that we live in, right? We are caught in this wheel, and it's not like we can just step out of it and choose not to participate, because I mean that's survival, right? But I love this thought that Cord Jefferson had, who did American Fiction, when he did his speech, and I think I don't know if you saw that, but he was talking about how respectfully he was requesting that studios consider funding $10 to $20 million movies over the big tentpole movies. And I thought that was a brilliant statement, because it's spot on. Yeah. It's like,
you have no idea how happy that just made me.
Yeah. Like he was like, you know, American Fiction was probably like a $20 million movie. And, again, one of those that like Wyoming's the last to get a lot of the movies that I want to see. So I got to wait another 6 months, but, I'm really, really excited for, you know, people like him, because he's advocating for the kind of movie we need right now. The weird movies, the smaller scale movies that really dream an adventure in a completely different realm than the big tentpole movies, which I believe are necessary, right? You know, they're the big ones. Send them out there. Why not? But, you know, you got to have something else to balance that scale. Yeah.
My only caveat is I want the superhero movies to crash and burn, except maybe Batman at this point. I have loved superheroes and comic books when I was a kid, but like I'm 31 years old, of course, so I'm an adult. And also I'm just like, these movies are bad for the world. They literally need to stop. Like it's weird to say that, but I actually think that is objectively materially accurate, that these films are not good for humanity. Mm-hmm. And, so that's where I'm at with the mainstreams. I like Barbie. I like Oppenheimer. I like big films. I like the spectacle. I love it. But I agree. One of the thoughts I had, and I was talking with a bunch of horror fans, I was saying that why doesn't Netflix pony up like $5 million each and give them to a bunch of filmmakers who are really promising, like, you know, mainly like people of color, women, and just being like, have at it. You get to make whatever you want. You find a script or you write your own script, you direct it, enjoy.
Yeah.
Like, take $5 million. It's the least amount you probably can give, you know, while being able to profit. Like, go ahead. That's what they should do.
Yeah.
And they won't really do that, or they're going to make the most like cliched, crappy version of it. One of my friends was watching Bad Hair when she was staying with me, the Hulu movie, and it's just awful. I mean, really? It's trying to be hip and up to date. It's about, like, you know, black women's hair being evil, right? Like, becoming evil. And it just looks terrible. Like, the effects are terrible. The look is terrible. The dialogue's bad. And it's like, this should have been good. What are we doing?
Yeah.
Are we letting the robots write this? Is that what's happening? I don't know.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think you have hit the nail right on the head in regards to the MBAs coming in and ruining not just the corporate spaces, but the entertainment industry as well. I certainly agree with that. But I got a couple more questions here to be mindful of your time. Sure. I'm probably going to ask you some recommendations at the end of the show here, because I love the aesthetic that you're reaching for. I think it's very spot on. But let's talk a little bit more about Birdsongs, just so that we can kind of encapsulate it a bit more. What was the feeling that you have here getting this book out into the world? Because it's been out for a little while, or is it coming this month?
A couple weeks.
Okay, perfect.
This month, yeah, for a couple weeks.
Yeah. So what are you feeling, you know, as this is about to come into the world? Was there something that you left on the table with this, more to explore around the same topics, or do you feel like this is the end of the chapter, full stop?
That's a really good question. I'm done for now writing about punk or like punk influences or like my past with the punk stuff. I am writing an essay for one outlet. I enjoy music. I'm going to be writing about being in the Bay Area hardcore scene for a little bit, but I think that's it in terms of my writing, at least for now. So in terms of my poetry, yeah, I don't want to write about that again. I feel like it's just kind of going over old territory. I'm still happy to, I don't want to be seen as the punk poet. It becomes a cliche or a cross to bear. What I do want to write about is, yeah, more surrealism, less confessionalism. I think I'm done with that. And what I feel now is mainly proud. I feel this sense of closure. But also this sense of like, I am an author. I have a book out. Like, it's an official book. It's not a chapbook, which, hey, chapbooks are great. I love them. I've written them. They're wonderful. No hatred to the chapbooks. It's just cool to write like a full length book and be like, this is mine. I've done something.
Yeah.
It's an accomplishment. It feels good.
Yeah. So, when you make it with Alien Buddha Press, what were they like to work with? What was that experience?
Oh, great. I mean, you know, mostly no complaints. The only thing is I've had to do the promotion on my own, but I feel like that actually has been a pretty good one-on-one kind of experience. I learned a lot about marketing and getting my own books out. One thing you kind of realize is how much of the book review racket is a little bit of a grift. Like, Kirkus Reviews and Booklist, you have to pay $300 to $400 to get your book reviewed. And sometimes you'll get a negative review and there will be no refund. And I was just reading this and like, nope. Like, I'm not with a mainstream publisher. I'm with a small press. This is a grift. I'm good. So that has just been eye-opening, honestly. Yeah. Like, releasing the book has been eye-opening. Finding out what I can do for it, what I can send it out. It's fun, too, because it does feel like I'm going back to my DIY band days, in that I'm shilling this book out to people. I'm pitching this project. I'm telling people about it. Like, put it in your bookstore. Right now it's carried in 4 bookstores, and I'm looking to get it hopefully in New York and Boston. I think that would be really nice, maybe in California if I can. So both of those, all of those are really promising ideas, maybe Baltimore.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
So I wonder if down the road you might have a either an essay or a short book on DIY marketing strategies from the punk scene. I think that might be beneficial to a lot of people because we need some more do-it-yourself sort of indie kind of approaches to I guess the poetry market. Even though it seems to be thriving, yeah. I mean everyone's writing poetry right now.
It's funny that it's we're post Insta poetry now, especially because Instagram literally like changed their algorithm to say fuck you poetry essentially, which is awful, but also means we're not getting so many Rupi Kaurs and poets who I think are frankly like they're not trying hard and they're not playing with language and they're not pushing the form. Whereas I it's funny because I actually think social media poetry is intriguing if you really play with the device. Mm. No, that's a great point, though. I think that where we're at is really promising. Like, we have so many thriving scenes. I'm really close by to the New Jersey Poetry Renaissance. I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's like a very punk-oriented like poetry scene in Jersey that's very like loyal and based around like everyone coming together. I read in Asbury Park at one of the venues, and that was just a blast. Like, what a great crowd. So I want to go back to Jersey and do that again, obviously. Mm. Yeah, where we're at right now is good, especially in the East Coast. Apparently Boston's struggling with its poetry. I just heard from a friend of mine. I don't know the details, but I think we're in a good place. We just need... Americans need to read more. I don't know how else to say it. We need a lot more literacy, focus on books. We are again at this point where the people in charge of the economy probably read mainly nonfiction about business. And again, this is a serious problem. These are not creative people. I mean, Frank Zappa, I think, talked about this, that like the music industry changed when it wasn't old guys in suits who trusted you and just assumed that you probably knew what you were doing and you were hip enough to understand what the kids wanted. Then the marketing guys came in and they're all 20 and 30 somethings and also in suits, but they're like, we know what people want. Mm. So we'll just make them conform to it.
Yeah.
And that actually was a huge problem in the 80s. So,
Man, and it's a shame that here we are, you know, almost 40 years, 50 years on, and similar issues have now just been exacerbating
worse,
the culture.
Wow. Yeah.
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 But I'm,
no, Zappa would be horrified. I'm not even a Zappa fan, but I remember seeing this interview and being like, he's right. When you're right, you're right.
Yeah. I'd like you to share the latest work that you're really, really into. And I want you to go the full gamut here. If there's any books, movies, or music in particular, things that that have really been inspiring you, lighting the way toward more creativity for you, what's something that just makes you want to synthesize the world around you in terms of art that you've experienced? Ago, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 2 days ago, I watched The Zone of Interest, which is Jonathan Glazer's film, based on Rudolf Haas, and I don't know if I'm saying that right. I apologize to any Germans, but I also don't know if should I apologize for mispronouncing a Nazi's name. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. So Rudolf Haas was the commandant of Auschwitz, and he lived right next to the camp, like behind the barbed wire. He had a garden. He had a little pool, like a fountain, and he had children. Like, he had wife and children. They all lived there, and they were pretty happy. And the horror of this movie is that they're happy and you just hear screams and gunshots and you see the smoke coming out of the chimneys. And that this movie profoundly inspired me in the sense that here is a depiction of the, not the banality of evil, because that's a tired phrase, and you know it's been misused, frankly. It's a depiction of how you can just go about your day all day, not just in the service of evil, but you are directly benefiting from its existence, from human suffering, from destruction and murder. And you can have a nice bourgeois life doing that. And that is something I find very recognizable coming from a family where a lot of my extended family was like upper middle class, upper class, bourgeois. And I did find something a little unsettling about it, frankly, because at a certain point you start to notice like, oh, all of our waiters are people of color. Like, you know, if you're in a club, you go to a club and you start to notice things like that, you pick up on it, or you're like, there's like a genocide going on right now, but we're not talking about it at Christmas dinner. Okay.
You're so sanitized. Yeah. Yeah.
Sanitizing. And while it's happening around you, and I was thinking about that too, in terms of like, there was an orange sky in Philadelphia, June 8th, because of the Canadian wildfires. And it's that sense of like, how do you go about your day while horrific things are happening? How do you endure this stuff? And the great thing about Zone of Interest, it's about people who don't endure anything. They are actually quite content. The wife doesn't want to move. She's really happy in this place next to the death camps. She's happy. And it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
But you're also like, yeah, because you're a Nazi. It makes sense for you because you are a racist and you are complicit in mass murder.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the movie that really influenced me. Also, the use of sound in it is starting to like really hit me. I want to see it again, but I don't know what it says about me that I want to see it again in a theater.
No, I think you want to look further into the feeling. You want to explore the feeling more, but my God, Jonathan Glazer doesn't miss. That's why I'm so excited to see that one. Like, he knocks it out of the park.
It's haunting.
Oh my God.
I walked out of the theater and then like sat back down because I realized I was bursting into tears and was just like deeply upset.
Yeah.
I wasn't. At the same time, the movie's about resistance too. Like, there are people in the movie very quietly who will not go by this. And I won't go into the rest of the movie, but
sure,
there is a sense of like, not everyone believes in this and not everyone is going to sit by quietly and just endure or enjoy their lives. No one's going to just enjoy their lives while this is happening. So that was something that I liked, that not all hope is lost either.
Oh, that's amazing. And now I can't wait to watch it even more. I think it's going to be an amazing, amazing show. Oh, excellent. So last question here. I know that we've kind of covered so many things and I got to tell you, this has been such a blast. And I really, once again, I'm really looking forward to reading more of your work and learning more about your aesthetic as I read more of your work down the road. But please let me know if there's another opportunity to chat. I'd love to catch up with you down the road when you have the next one, you know, lined up, because this has been a blast.
That'd be great.
Yeah, yeah. But I've been thinking a lot recently about this idea of a life well lived, especially as a creative person who has to deal with a lot of these capitalist constraints, with these existential concerns that are all over the place. And as we try to craft a life that is bearable, that is tolerable through the work that we do, and trying to overcome a lot of these obstacles, whether you're working class or, you know, in various different stations, like, what do you think works for you? How have you reconciled the madness that is happening in the world, and what kind of role has creativity and art taken in that kind of healing?
Part of it is meds, which definitely help. I think that the creativity is cathartic. I don't always know if it's healing. I am a little skeptical of the view in general that this is a recent view. I think it's come up more and more, and I think it is artists trying to justify, you know, why they do what they do, and it's this idea of like, art will save you, art will heal you. I don't always think that's true. I think art is just something you sometimes do. I also agree with Wilde, you know, his principles about art being meaningful and meaningless. I think it is okay that art can be stupid or not particularly essential. I do think, we run into this problem where everything has to be important. And I don't think that's true. You don't have to read my book. You should, but you know, you should give me money, but I would never insist on my own greatness in that light. I don't think I'm that special, or I'm trying not to see myself that way. And I really think more artists should try that, because guys, or anybody, when you talk about, like, you know, oh, my role in creation. I don't know. It's a little exhausting.
I think that's a great ruminative note to end on, because we need to ask ourselves a lot of that question. And I, once again, can't thank you enough, man. This has been such a blast, Connor. And I hope that folks go and check out Bird Songs, which is now available, or should be available real soon, from Alien Buddha Press. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have
now,
we're going to have some links in the episode description. But let's talk again, Connor. This has been a blast. Talk to me about movies and music and all kinds of stuff.
Sure.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Thanks, Jamie.
So hang on for just a bit. I'm going to keep recording, but I'll talk to you real soon. Thanks again.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you. Take care.